From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. It's been almost 10 years since David Chase was last here for what I think was a terrific feature film, Not Fade Away, one of my favorite soundtracks of the century. And he's now a co-writer and brings the story of The Sopranos to the big screen with The Many Saints of Newark. David, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And before we got started, you were asking when we met, and Almost Grown was when we met. And I was writing about it for Rolling Stone. And
oh, my God, right.
You know, back when I almost had a career and you went on to have a career. But what struck me in watching Many Saints of Newark is we're almost in that same period where Almost Grown began. And I could some way almost hear Time Has Come Today, which is the clock in Almost Grown, which you co-wrote mm-hmm. with Lawrence Connor, who wrote Many Saints of Newark with you. But also, again, I think Almost Grown is one of the greatest pilots I've ever seen because it starts with impatience, with Tim Daly's character storming out of the house and looking for refuge in that car and punching buttons on that car radio until he finds What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. And that same kind of impatience and that need to escape being trapped inside four walls with tension is really the heart of The Many Saints of Newark.
I never thought of it that way, but it's true. Yeah. I'm tempted to ask you, what does that mean?
No. Nobody's listening to the show to hear me.
Okay.
I want to ask you what that means, because again, we go back to Almost Grown, incredible pilot and short-lived series that David and Lawrence Connor did in 1988. I was a high school intern at Rolling Stone at the time, obviously. I mean, I think that thread runs so much through what you did in that show and Sopranos and that idea of impatience and just feeling trapped inside of a house and what it does, because what we can say about this movie, interestingly, is that people are very different outside versus inside. And there's this tension. There's one great scene where people feel free, a post-coital scene. I'm not going to give anything else away about. That's one of the best things you've ever done with two incredible actors. But for the most part, being inside, it's a big part of Not Fade Away, too. That kind of tension, that kind of anguish, that anxiety that being trapped inside with other people creates.
Well, here's what I think I know. When I was 15 through 20-something, I got totally, like, the jitters being in the house. But that's every kid, isn't it? I had to get, especially at night, I had to get out of there. The idea that there would be something going on that I wasn't part of used to drive me crazy. And I remember one time one of my best friends ditched me, never came to pick me up. And I've never forgiven him, in a sense. And I'm not sure that people that age now feel that way. But I don't know. I don't know those people. I know my daughter. When she got her license, she took the car. And I said, well, you have to go pick up your mother. And we got into an argument. And she said, "F you," and she took the keys and she left. And for that reason, she got to be on The Sopranos. Because I made her go to, like, my father used to make me go to work in the hardware store. Okay, you want to be, you're going to come to work with me. Well, I did the same thing to her. You're going to come to work with me. So she came down to Brillstein Gray and she was doing Xeroxing and stuff. And she asked if she could read, and she did, and she got a part. And there was no favoritism extended, believe me. But I'm not answering your question.
Yes, you are.
I don't know the answer. That's your interpretation about, what would you call it, agitation or?
Yeah, agitation or anxiety. I mean, it's all these things, you know? And I just sort of think, I mean, I sort of see this through line, you know, and between Tim's character and Dickie Moltisanti and even Tony. I mean, it's a kind of generational thing. I mean, it's this weird way, this thing that pop triggered for people, you know, the thing you were talking about not wanting to be in the house, about feeling like there's something bigger and greater, because it's that thing that Tony talks about in the pilot, that greater purpose being that Americans had disappearing before his eyes. And I just saw all these connections between all these things, just because I'm sort of hard-pressed to think of anybody who deals with impatience, people being stuck in a moment and wanting to get out of it, and what that does, and how people react, and how people react so differently. For some people, it's violent. For some people, like Livy, obviously, it becomes this way of creating the same anxiety for others that she feels for herself. But it's fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, The Sopranos was intended to be, and was my feelings about America at that time, which I felt was headed for something not good, having to do with self-interest and self-regard and selfishness. And the joke was never in the show, but when I was writing it, the joke I told myself was, things are so greedy and so bad and so selfish that even a mobster can't take it. That was the kind of the guiding principle.
But it's funny, because that nightmare you're talking about has been what this country's been living through for almost the last 4 years. This apotheosis of self-absorption and
Absolutely.
I me mine.
Yeah, I mean, the show was ahead of what happened. I felt something wrong. I mean, when you talk about impatience, you know, there's a play by Arthur Miller, maybe you know the name of it, I don't recall it. And there's this old Jewish tailor or something, a character. And he says, if the stores in this country shut down for 3 days straight, there would be a revolution. And it's absolutely true. Without shopping, we don't know what to do.
Yeah, and now we can do it in our homes or in our cars. We never have to leave. It's inescapable now.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, I guess what we're talking about here, though, for me, and by the way, is the treatment. And my guest, who thinks the best way to punish your kid is to put it on your TV show, is David Chase, whose new film is The Many Saints of Newark. But this way of dealing with patience, or impatience rather, and trying to get your hands around it, is the difference between adolescence and adulthood. And those two poles are always bouncing against each other in what you do.
Oh, that's interesting. That's true about adolescence and adulthood, alleged adulthood. I don't know. Adulthood seems to last a lot longer now. I mean, adolescence seems to last a lot longer.
To me, it's fascinating, because it becomes a way that wanting to have things, and that becomes a big part of what this movie is about too. People wanting things and thinking somehow that things will offer a moment's peace or escape.
Yeah. I always felt that the series itself, people say, what was it about? And, you know, it was about a lot of different things, but I think at its root, it was about money and death. And the two are related.
But that always seemed evident to me. And I think, too, that illusion that surrounding yourself with these things will somehow make your life that much easier. No, it's the line that's been attributed to so many people, but where the things you want for you shall have them. And I just think about how many times in The Sopranos, Tony's talking about things and his affection for something he used to have, because he could never appreciate in the moment that he had it.
Right. Yeah, he's kind of a nostalgist. Yeah, he kind of lives in nostalgia.
We're talking so much in broad terms, which I'm trying to do because I don't want to give too much of the movie away, but I guess a question I had is, how often do you sit down, especially in the case of The Many Saints of Newark, and think about thematically what you want to do versus narrative terms? Because there's so much built up and you've got so much you can use in terms of narrative. I wonder if thinking about who these people were and where they were going to be and starting it in a riot, a literal riot, and a riot to contrast with the summer of love that's supposed to be going on around everywhere. I mean, just if contradictions or something thematically you were looking to do with this.
I have to say no. No, it was all about the narrative. I personally have never sat down and start to write from a thematic point of view. It's only stories. You know, it's all about stories. And people tell stories. And human beings, I was talking about this with a psychiatrist the other day. human beings love stories. They really do. And I don't know why. They're extremely important. So I never think about thematics. But you're somehow or other, it does always come back to the same place for me. So I guess there's something, I mean, the whole thing about the materialism of America in the series, I will tell you, I'm as guilty, if not more guilty, than the next person in terms of coveting stuff, cars, stereo systems, you name it. And I never think of, oh, well, this is an escape. I think, oh, it's so beautiful. So I got to have that thing. Without that preamp, the whole thing is ridiculous.
As we're talking about this too, I can't help but think about the way young Tony, and not to give too much away, is aspiring, because that period, and it connects, you revisit a lot, but it kind of connects Not Fade Away, Almost Grown, and Many Saints, that period where there was this kind of aspiration to be something greater or to be part of something greater. And we can even see it visited in his sort of great uncle kind of twin played by Ray Liotta. I mean, the character who's given up that quest for things and has found peace in, of all places, prison.
Right. Well, it wasn't until we were finished writing the script for In the Many Saints of Newark that I realized it was taking place in 1967, which was very important to Not Fade Away, because it was Sergeant Pepper. And those guys had already changed everything. And that was like an atomic bomb. And I didn't realize, oh, here I am back again in 1967. And I've been telling myself lately, if I do any more work, I have to get out of the 60s. It's not because people think it's nostalgia, but it isn't nostalgia. A lot of important things happened then. In fact, this whole miasma we're living through right now started then. All this confusion, this turmoil, this hatred, this division started then. Remember Nixon's silent majority? Those were the guys who were smashing their way into the Capitol building. Not so silent anymore.
No, they're not. I mean, but I've never thought of you as being a nostalgist. I guess I always think of your work in terms of, right down to the way the music is chosen, that time, we're almost always aware of the count in the music that's played in these songs and what that does for people. And I think you keep going back to this period because, again, what I was saying, there's so many contradictions that you have the Summer of Love in the period where there were riots almost every year in the 60s and in several cities at the same time. And so to have these two ideas existing simultaneously, the baby boom generation trying to will this peaceful utopia into being at the same time, people of color are saying, you can't do that if you're going to ignore what we've gone through. The people trying to grapple with several complex ideas simultaneously is what it feels like fascinates you about the 60s to me.
It just was, we started this by talking to Stevie, said it was a renaissance. A renaissance means a rebirth. I don't know what was being reborn in the 60s, but it broke everything. It broke every rule and every, and I'm not saying this from like, kick the jam out, motherfucker. I'm not saying that, or kick out the jams. I'm saying whatever it was, look at all the deaths and assassinations. The death of both Kennedy brothers, Martin Luther King.
Malcolm X. Medgar Evers,
yeah. And yet it's called, the love generation. LSD is called a love drug. It's wild now that you think about it.
We're going to take a break. My guest, who corrected himself on the MC5 quote, is David Chase. His new film is, I don't want to call it a prequel, but a new Sopranos drama, The Many Saints of Newark, playing in movie theaters. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on the Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Seen on the Screen is available now wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is our old friend David Chase, whose new project is The Many Saints of Newark, a Sopranos film playing in theaters. Before we get into that, I have to say something that I thought about. The last time you were here, we talked pretty extensively about Charlie Watts, and you were the first person I thought of when he passed away.
I know. That was, well, maybe that's something we shouldn't get into. It's a sidetrack, but you know, it makes you wonder about the whole future of that band and everything. And, you know, I mean, I'll say this, that, you know, to be a genius, to know, I was thinking a lot. It's coming. One of those guys, how old are they? Somebody's got to go. But I never thought of him.
Well, when you think, that's kind of a long time to go between, you know, to go from Brian to Charlie, that's 50 years. I mean, that's, that's a pretty good record. But I guess I thought about him because what we were talking about, and it was, again, a character in sort of a frame around not Fade Away, being time. And again, I think back to Almost Grown and that Chambers Brothers song and how crucial that was. The way the music here is so much in this way about sort of keeping time. We can almost feel that schism between the Rolling Stones and what Dean Martin said about them on TV. In this movie, I mean, that there are so many complications and contradictions. And for, again, we're going to talk about contradictions. I don't want to get too much into it, but prison being the most peaceful place for somebody because it strips everything away and makes you confront the person you are.
I guess so. I mean, I guess I just felt there's nothing else to do, you know? So he might as well read. I guess that was the way I looked. We looked at it, me and Larry. But we never really talked about why is he like that. I just know that there are convicts that are extremely philosophical and well-read and you know, jailhouse lawyers and all that.
Sure, but there are also people who, you know, who's, as you make clear, whose violence and inability to deal with being, if you pardon the expression, almost grown, lead to these kind of paroxysms that are no good for anybody, including finally themselves. I'm trying not to be too specific about what's going on in the movie because I don't want to give it away. But you said something really interesting was that you didn't realize until you guys had finished writing that it was 1967. But how did you end up landing on that time?
Let's put it this way. While I was writing Not Fade Away or making it, both of these movies are not just set in 1967. This one goes from 67 to 70-something. But while I was doing Not Fade Away, and maybe while I was living that life, when Sergeant Pepper came out, that's all I really knew about. How much did I know about the Newark riots happening 8 miles away? How involved was I with that? My girlfriend at the time, my wife, was working in downtown Newark at the Prudential Insurance Company, and I used to drive her to work every day. I remember sitting around with my friends at night, saying, I hope they burn that place down. Kick out the jams, motherfucker, right? And I thought, wait a minute. They need to go down there. Hold on, you know? And I never saw a single flame from where we were. So what do I really know about it? I think I said something the other day that after George Floyd was murdered, well, we made this movie. We actually shot the majority of this movie before the murder of George Floyd, okay? And it was in the can. And it was about the riots, yeah. That was all there. We didn't change a lot of that. And then COVID happened. We all get to go home for a year and come back to it. And George Floyd has been murdered and everything that comes after that happens. And turns out the movie, people say it was prescient. And I said to whoever I was talking to, I was so surprised. My God, nothing has changed. It's still the same. I was surprised. Well, and I realized as I was saying that, well, I'm sure Black people weren't surprised. They knew it was all still the same. So there's a lot to deal with.
I guess we have to say, too, that often in these things, we get a chance, the stories are being told, especially in The Sopranos, are about the character's ignorance towards Black people and Black culture. And to sort of play these two mirrors against each other. And again, for me, it's at 67, but it's also, I can't help but think about the way Black people reacted to The Time Has Come Today versus the way white people reacted to it. You know, that we get a chance to see Harold played so well by Leslie Odom Jr.
Here's the best thing he does. He drags his feet. When he's walking back from the car and he's been given that tip, he's dragging his feet. It sounds like he's got cleats on. It is so cool and so real. Anyway, I interrupted.
No, I was just going to, I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to start talking about how we realize who he is physically. And how we get to see him evolve physically from those early times with Dickie to becoming the person he is, and how the way his shoulders sit change. Just to sort of see as Dickie just sort of seems to get smaller and smaller and more wound up by these things that are eating at him, we're watching Harold flower in his way.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good point, getting smaller and smaller, getting ground up. Yeah. You know, the thing about it is that I always liked was that Harold is alive. He comes up from North Carolina. He's alive for the riots. The riots open his eyes in some way. And his answer to it is to start a business. He doesn't join the Panthers. He doesn't give them a dime. In fact, we had a scene that we never shot because we just couldn't, where a Panther hits him up and says, "You're going to be a big success, and can we count on you to, help fund the children's breakfast?" He never did any of that stuff. He became an extreme capitalist. I guess that's the American story, really.
It is, but it also is. It's too about that thing you were talking about in the first half about how that kind of sort of self-directedness becomes a way. But he also is somebody who sees that the way these guys operate, and the light that goes off in his head is, and it's interesting because we can see it being realized physically, by the way he starts to use his hands in front of him. "I'm as smart as these guys. I'm smarter than this guy. Why should I do this?"
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. Right.
It's the treatment. The guy who's agreeing with me about his movie is David Chase. We're talking about his new film, The Many Saints of Newark. I was lucky, and I will encourage people to do this, that I got to see it in a theater where you get a chance to see these physical tensions realized and hear these things, but also see the way that the Harold, and this goes obviously to Alan Taylor's direction, but also having Leslie in the movie, the way he inhabits the frame. He starts moving closer and closer to the center of the frame, if we're paying attention, from when he's introduced to the time where he gets to really become who he is. And those are all great things to see on a big frame to me.
I have to say this. I mean, the studio probably, although I was told by the guy who came up with the day and date thing, that it's understandable that filmmakers would be upset with that. But it really, I think this movie begs to be seen on a big screen, and that people shouldn't say, "Well, you know, Sopranos looked okay on a small screen. Let's stay home." It's a different experience, really.
But it's a different story too, because again, the whole frame is being used, and all these things we're talking about that Leslie does, these physical things, you can really see in the big frame. I mean, and you can also see how Alessandro Nivola is diminished constantly. That was obviously something you guys were working towards in script terms for these actors to play out, wasn't it?
I wish I could say it was. Seriously. No, I mean, thematically, it happens, okay, what you're saying. But did Larry and I think about screen sizes and who's in the frame where? No, we did not. Now, maybe there's something in the writing of any particular scene that dictates somebody's got to be bigger and somebody's got to be small. But I've never noticed that before.
You tell me, because, I mean, it's so much about the aggression of The Sopranos is about the way people enter rooms and the impact they make, or somebody sitting in the center of the room and the way people revolve around those characters. Whereas in Not Fade Away, it was about people almost hanging around the edge of the frames trying to look, looking for a way to get out.
Well, you're more perceptive than I am, seriously. I'll tell you this, though. If you were to go back and watch The Sopranos, every scene, somebody enters the frame. We hardly never cut to the middle of a scene, to the middle of a conversation, to anything like that. In fact, you know, it's kind of a joke or a diss that everybody's always going, there he is. And people would come through the door and the scene would go on. We never started in the middle of the scene.
Well, that's why I brought this thing about entrances, you know, because just watching to prepare for this, but actually remembering all these things and how often when somebody walked into the frames and somebody was already sitting, like Tony being there in the center of the frame, being at his desk at the Bing, we were aware of the way that person kind of walked in to try to get his attention and trying to read his mood as he walked into the room. But that movement, and that's a big part of this thing too, though. That's why I was talking about that, for me, that great scene, that great, I don't want to say still scene, but the kind of peaceful scene where two characters who should be together and tensions of the time and who they are and not being able to be who they should be, right, maybe prevent that. But that is such a great scene, and it feels like something to me that a kind of scene you want to write for a long time.
Yeah, that's true. I think I know the scene you're talking about. In fact, I know the scene you're talking about. Steal Away scene. Dark End of the Street. Yeah. Yeah, I love that stuff. I mean, I love those songs. And there were those two people in that hotel room.
No, I mean, it's the moment of calm. But even then, there's a bit of anxiety about them being in that room because they're actually sort of carving away these moments for themselves.
Yeah.
Again, I just found myself thinking so often about rooms, interiors, and what that does to people, and ceilings, because ceilings are so important in these things. You sort of feel that oppressiveness of the ceiling not being high enough.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, Hollywood made many wonderful movies with most or all wonderful movies with the same pressures and with no ceilings on the set. So I don't know.
Well, we're out of time. Come back and agree with me anytime you want, David. It's always good to talk to you.
Okay, I'll agree to that. Mm-hmm.
And congratulations on the movie. I hope you're happy with it.
Thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Always good to talk to you. My guest is David Chase. And make another film soon. TV's great, but do you have another movie in mind you want to do, by the way, before we go?
Yes, I do. And guess what?
What?
It's in the 60s. It starts in 54. And it ends in 71.
No kidding, really?
Yeah.
Perfect. Because I've got to say, between Not Fade Away and this, we can feel your love for the big screen.
Oh, yeah. But that's all about Alan, really. You know, I love the big screen, but he put it on the big screen.
Yeah, but who put Not Fade Away on the big screen?
Yeah, I did. That's true.
Okay, therein lies my point. And we can end on a disagreement. Again, my guest is
okay,
David Chase.
All right. We're not going to disagree about that. I did do that.
We're back to disagreeing the way we always do. My guest is David Chase, again, whose new feature film project is The Many Saints of Newark. Our production staff includes Katie Gilchrist, John Meek, Paul Smith, and Desmond Taylor. The show was edited and produced by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. That's